Hi, everyone. My name is Scott Robbins. I'm a marketing manager for Kids Can Press, formerly of Scholastic. And I'm moderating a panel today on, from comic books to graphic novels, the wide world of mainstream publishing. So I just wanted everyone to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about the project that they're currently working on with the mainstream publisher. And just a little bit of background on where you came from.
I'd like to start. I'm Raina Tolkemeyer, and I am living in New York City, originally from San Francisco. I started out doing mini comics, a mini comic called Takeout, and that was kind of the first comics I drew for public consumption. And the editors at Scholastic US noticed the mini comics because I live in New York, and they're in New York, so. They frequent a lot of like the comic events in New York City, and they found my minis that way, and they asked if I would do adaptations of the Babysitter's Club as comics, so that's the mainstream project that I'm working on. I also have a webcomic called Smile, smilecomics.com. That's like the third thing that I regularly work on, so I'm all over the place.
Wow, this room really does have lousy acoustics. Do you guys hear us better if we just project or if we use the microphones? Okay. I've been self-publishing my own comic. My name's Carlos Peter McNeil. I've been self-publishing my own comic Finder since 1997, but first as mini comics and then as, you know, quote-unquote real comics. And I'm currently under contract to adapt a young adult bestseller series called Pendragon for Simon & Schuster.
I can't project, so I'm going to use the mic. I'm Keen Sue. I have that posture. I do a comic called Jellybee. It was picked up recently by Hyperion Books for Children. That's coming out in February. I'm also a co-editor on Flight, which is an anthology of sort of all-ages comics. And I think...
Awesome.
Yeah. They're kind of awesome, I think. And I sort of got my start also sort of just doing web comics and posting from there, and that sort of led to all of these different publishing things that's going on now.
I'm Hope Larson. I started out in web comics also. Keen and I have a website together, the Secret Friend Society, and my first graphic novel, Salamander Green, started out on there, along with Jellybee. And it was later published by Ad House Books. I also did a book for Oni Press, and just completed Chiggers, which is a young adult graphic novel for Simon & Schuster's Genuso Press. And also last year, I published Rebecca Kratz's House of Sugar through my own small press. So I've got a lot of stuff going.
You're diversified. That's cool.
Thank you. So the big question that we're exploring on this panel is, as you can see in the program, is that are comics finally taking their place in the mainstream as they did on the newsstands 50 years ago, and are graphic novels basically here to stay as a valid and important format in the bookstores, the bookstore market, the industry? Or is this just a fad? Now, I just got some figures here, some sales figures. The sale of graphic novels hit $333 million in 2006, and that's a 12% increase from 2005. And basically, the sales of graphic novels in bookstores have quadrupled since 2001. So that's just a little bit of sales figures to give you guys something to chew on. You can talk to me about talk to the rest of people about whether you think that this is it. Like, you know, comics are now here to stay, and that the audience is just going to grow larger and larger as time goes on. Right?
Well, that's a question.
Yeah.
Well,
are comics here to stay? Are comics now a viable and valid format for mass consumption?
I certainly hope so. I guess that's what I do. Feel free to jump in at any time and help me out with this, guys.
Well, I can honestly say that most of the pros that I've spoken to from New York think it's here to stay. The same thing happened with children's books back in the 70s. You know, before the 70s, You know, you had all the venerable old favorites. You had Dr. Seuss and a couple of other well-remembered oldies. But all of a sudden, this tremendous explosion took place, and all and any illustrator that could, you know, hold an implement that would make a mark was making just the most amazing, beautiful books. And anybody could do one then. Anybody could get anything published. And, of course, it boomed and burst. But at the end of it, you know, there's this enormous section full of beautiful picture books and clever little, you know, strange things for kids. And the field was broadened after the bubble burst. So we probably will see a bubble, and there probably will be some wreckage before it all settles down. But I really do think that at the end of it, there will be a much larger presence in the mainstream for comics and graphic novels.
And so where do you see that we're at right now? Are we at the bubble, or are we near the bubble, or are we near the burst?
Nowhere near the burst.
Yeah. I think we're miles away from... I think we're just getting to the bubble right now. Because I think the publishers are really still... And I have a huge learning process on what it's like to make a comic, sort of from the production side of things, and to get the word out about these books that they're sort of going through this whole new channel that they're distributing these books through. So I think there's a lot of room for expansion right now.
Yeah. All the professional, well, the fancy schmancy big contract professional illustrators haven't caught on to it yet.
Yeah.
You know, some of them have, the ones that always had their eye on comics and, you know, might have always kind of toyed with the idea of doing one. They're starting to do it now. You know, you go to San Diego and you see all the Pixar guys and some of the other animators coming around kind of shyly with their own comics, like, here, I'm a latecomer. But, you know, some of them are really beautiful, and of course we're always happy to have them. But, you know, it hasn't reached that everybody with a lead holder getting into the act part yet. That's when the bubble will really be like this.
But there's room for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's so many different types of comics out there on the market now that just did not exist even, like, 5 years ago. And there's editors in the field who are looking for stuff that's different, and they're not just looking for comics about pirates and superheroes anymore.
Zombies.
So it's like... You can write a story about girls at summer camp, and there's going to be an editor that's willing to publish that. And you can write a story about a little girl with her monster, and publishers are looking for something like that. A little girl with her monster, that doesn't quite
that
explain it,
fine.
But...
Yeah, that's about right.
So, essentially, what you guys are saying is that this is a whole new ballgame in terms of new creators, that, you know, back in the day, you guys sort of come up the ranks, you had to prove yourself, and a lot of times that was through Marvel and DC, and all of you guys have come from either self-publishing or doing mini comics, and have jumped right into mainstream publishing, which is really amazing. Do you think that this is going to open up an opportunity for a whole new sort of group of cartoonists to get their work out there?
I feel like right now there are more opportunities for people to draw comics than there are people who are skilled to fill those positions.
Well, but
that's fair.
The more people out there that start reading comics, whether they're young or old, the more people that are going to want to draw them. So I hope that we're growing like a new generation of talent by making stuff for them to read in the first place.
I don't know about you, but when I see people reading comics on the subway, or like reading, like kids like 10 years old, you know, sitting in a bookstore reading Bone or Babysitter's Club, it's pretty cool. Have you ever had a story or a situation where you've encountered a kid reading your own stuff?
God, I hope not. No, not really. It's just that my stuff's kind of bent. It's not aimed at kids, but I do know what you mean. I had one of my star moments when one of my my distant relatives, you know, definitely Lady of the Garden Club type, found one of my more awful books on a shelf at a Borders where she was, you know, in between flights somewhere. Oh, found Carlos' book, blah, blah, blah. So that's about as close to, you know, a big mainstream breakthrough as I've had with my own book, I guess. But, you know.
I do meet a lot of kids at comic conventions now. Who,
that's good.
It's like... Now there's something for them to be there for. Like, it used to be that just their dads came to shows, but now their dads are bringing their daughters with them. And their sons, too. I get a lot of young boys that read these books too.
Cool.
Even though they're about girls. That's awesome.
Oh no.
No, it's okay.
The other thing too that we should talk about is this July we saw the release of the 7th Harry Potter book. And I know a bunch of creators who've been down in New York, and basically every editor in the industry said, please, thank God this is over, because now people are actually going to buy other stuff. Do you think that this is an opportunity for graphic novels to really sort of get in there and sort of really make its mark in sort of the children and the young adult bookstore market?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question for me, because my you know, that is where the biggest growth is in kids and young adults, and my own work is not aimed at children or young adults, and is, you know, probably entirely inappropriate for 99.9% of the kids that are out there. But at the same time, you know, that's where my mainstream work is going. The mainstream companies are very eager to get into this. But at the same time, in spite of the fact that they're the ones with the money, they're not the ones that really want to take the risks right now. That's why what I'm doing is an adaptation and not an original work. It's an adaptation of a series that became really popular during the you know, the first big hump in the Harry Potter hysteria, you know, before J.K. Rowling started to slow down. So, you know, I mean, it's a good kids' adventure series, but it's not anything like what I would do for myself.
Are you illustrating it as well as writing it?
What?
Are you illustrating it as well as writing it?
Oh yeah, I'm doing a total adaptation, soup to nuts.
Well, I think about the Harry Potter thing is that there's I'd be concerned about whether they're sort of limiting themselves to the kids market when there could be an expansion elsewhere. Like if that's all the comics that they want to make are sort of young adult and children's books, where are the sort of more literate or the fiction for the older. For the older people.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that's sort of a niche that's not being catered to widely enough, I think, right now by the mainstream, by the big book publishers, it seems to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely feel like a lot of publishers are focusing on girls between, I guess, about age 9 and, 16 or so?
Yeah, and like that's a monumental single group.
More 9 to 13 9 than to 13? Even 16, but...
And maybe neglect everybody else, especially I would think women, you know, like in their 20s and up. Maybe that's just because I don't feel like there's a lot of stuff specifically for me out there.
How about you guys talk a little bit about how you were quote unquote discovered? Just to sort of, you know, give people an idea of how that kind of works. Because, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of aspiring cartoonists out there, and I'm sure they'd love to hear how it happened and how they can make it happen for that.
I guess I'll start. I already touched upon it a little bit, but I was making mini comics. I was selling them at comic book stores and through festivals like TCAP and Mocha. And it was... streak of luck, like the exact time that Scholastic was starting up their graphics imprint, and I had a piece in an anthology published by Friends of Lulu, which is an organization dedicated to kind of like helping promote women in the comics industry. So we had a release party for that book, and an editor from Scholastic named Jana Morishima came to the party and saw my work there and asked if I wanted to submit something to Scholastic. And what I submitted as personal projects wasn't quite up their alley at the time. So they asked, so what did you read as a kid? Just out of conversation. And I said, well, I was a Babysitter's Club fan. And they said, well, why don't you try adapting that? And I was like, all right, that sounds like a cool job. And like 3 weeks later, they offered me a contract based on character sketches and a couple of like thumbnail chapters that I had done. So it happened really fast. And then they were like, the door is now open if you'd like to submit some of your own work. So I consider it like right place, right time. And just having had, you know, a couple of mini comics that I had self-published, so they knew I at least had like the comic chops to tell a story from start to finish, even if it was really short. And they had a lot of faith in me to then ask me to do 192 pages.
In 4 months, right? Yeah.
No.
Dilithium
Second
coastal.
Book was done in 6 months. first book took me a little longer. But I got a 4-book contract, so yeah, it happened fast.
Cool. I didn't get discovered. I went digging and found an agent. I networked my way to a guy that started shopping me around, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "Are you completely and utterly and totally married to your own stuff?" And I said, "No." And so he had apparently been putting together this adaptation thing for a long time with this particular deal with this particular original author to see if he could find a cartoonist who wanted to do the adaptation. And every time I said no, he came back with more money. So I finally said yes. And he's supposed to be shopping around my other work as well, and to see if he can find a publisher for that as well.
I guess I sort of started doing everything ass backwards. Hope and I had launched the Secret Pen Society website, and I was just sort of posting my Jelebi strips. I didn't have any intention to find a major book publisher. I was just sort of posting them at the time, and I think I was out of the blue. I got an email from someone at Disney Press that was interested, and I sort of then scrambled to find an agent to tell me what I should do and how I should go about taking it around to see if there's interest anywhere else. And it turned out that we ended up at Hyperion for Children, which was owned by Disney. And the editor that first contacted me at Disney Press was actually put out on loan to Hyperion to edit my book for me. So we basically ended up working together anyways.
That's cool.
So yeah, and I guess that's sort of, that's about it for me.
For me, I did my first 2 books, small press. So I was a little bit established at that point, and I was ready to, I was hoping to make enough money to actually just draw comics, because I'd been doing all this illustration work and I felt just spread so thin. So I figured that I should definitely jump to a book publisher, and I hooked up with my agent through Flight, which I was in with Keen, and put a pitch together, and she shopped it around, and we ended up placing me with Jeannie. So
I should add that I'm the weird one out here in that I don't have an agent, but I did work for a book publishing company for 4 years before I got into the comics publishing thing. So when it came to like looking at contracts, I'm not good at looking at contracts, but the editors that I worked with were. So I was able to go to their office and just be like, "Can you check this contract and see if it looks okay?" And they were like, "Change this thing out, $5,000 here, do this, do this, do this." And I did what they said and it worked. So I still don't have an agent, but there are times when I wish I did, when weird stuff starts to go down.
Being in a mainstream, or submitting to a mainstream publisher, it's in everyone's best interest to have an agent, because a lot of publishers won't look at stuff that if you don't have an agent. It's very rare for publishers to look at stuff if it's not coming through an agent.
And any agent that wants you to give him some money before he's ever actually done anything, just kick him and run away.
Oh yeah,
there are scam artists. Lots of scam artists, and there's going to be more who purport to be agents, and they want money up front to do things for you. Agents take percentages; they do not get fees. Don't let them lie to you. Most of them won't at first, but if the feeding frenzy really gets going, you never know what might happen.
There's a few websites out there. I don't know them offhand, but if you look up like agents on Google, there's actually like a website that lists bad agents.
It's called
They're terrible.
Predators and Editors.
Yes, that's
it. And it also lists agents. There was a question over here.
Yeah, so how does someone find it?
talk to your friends, ask who, find out a friend of yours who has one, or a friend of a friend, or a friend of a friend of a friend, and talk to them, see if you can get a phone number, send them your stuff. It's helpful if you have an online portfolio that you can just, "Hi, you don't know me, blah blah blah, here's my stuff, go check it out." Bam. And if they're interested, they will get in touch with you, especially right now.
A lot of agents, like book publishers, won't just take submissions from anybody. So you kind of need an in, or it's really helpful to have somebody who's already working
a personal
with an agent who can pass your work along.
Yeah, I mean, Hope and I are agents. We share the same agent, and we sort of found her through Flight, who was in turn, when she was representing Flight, she was recommended to us by Scott McLeod, who we had known through what we'd been doing with Flight, and Kazoo Kiwishi, our editor with Flight, was sort of conversing with him for a while. So he said, you know, maybe you should look into finding an editor to take Flight on, and so that's sort of how it trickled down to us as well. So it's sort of it is kind of a networky thing, which is something I sort of really hate, but
it's tricky. It's not linear. That's the problem.
Yeah, you never know who you could meet that could lead you to meeting the people that can really help you out. So
with book publishing is a lot like getting a book published. Very few submissions that come in to the slush pile, which is like basically you're sending in the line, get published. So it's like networking is like so important. So just like talk to as many people as you can and introduce yourself and get your name out there and something will happen.
And keep working, for heaven's sake.
Tying you into something that Raina had said before about, you know, having to go from a mini comic to a 192-page graphic novel, I just wanted to ask you guys what your experiences are going from being a self-publisher. So you basically you're in control of everything, especially your own deadlines. And what you have learned from the experience of working with editors, working with people in marketing, working with people in production, working with people in sales, and basically being sort of a puppet to the perpetual motion machine that...
Oh,
should we start with the puzzle?
Good to see you.
Oh, God. Get used to the idea that your inner 14-year-old, the one that you didn't think you had to worry about anymore, is going to come back. You're going to do, you know, whenever they say, no, you need to do it this way, you're going to pout for a while before you get used to it. Certainly I am. I just thought I was past all that stuff. You know, I thought I was grown up. And now that, you know, for the first time I have an editor who can say yay or nay or decide whether or not to pay me, I'm just all, you know, palpitating like a, you know, like a 17-year-old at 7 o'clock on prom night with no date going, oh, what is she going to call? Tell me it's okay. It's really stupid, but, you know, I'm sure I'll get used to it eventually.
Well, I think the biggest concern right now are the deadlines that that publishers seem to be setting for all of us, because I think right now, because everything is so new that they don't understand how long it'll take to produce a comic, a full comic, and writing and drawing and everything. And I think we're sort of in the position now that we have to push back a little and tell them this is how it's going to work. And I think that's sort of, I think it's a bit of our responsibility too, that sort of the position we're in right now.
I cried to my editor one time when I couldn't make a deadline. It's like, you don't understand, my arm is sore from drawing.
It's true, they don't know.
Yeah, and I totally freaked out too, like at the final month, basically. So
we all kind of have a support system, like on LiveJournal and stuff. Like, you don't understand.
It's funny the way the schedules work, because the book trade is used to having a book out for months and months and months and months and months before, you know, available to reviewers before it's available for sale, which is totally opposite to what happens here. You know, the minute we, you know, yank it out of the jaws of a photocopy machine, it's on sale. There's no sense in waiting because you have to get your money back on it. But at the same time, you know, in the book trade, they expect production to be really, 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 really short. Whereas we're, you know, accustomed maybe to the idea of putting up 2 or 3 pages a week on a web page and just sort of doodling along and fixing things as we go. So yeah, it's very two different, very very different worlds.
So spin this into a positive light. Like, what have you learned from this experience?
Publishers have money.
Yes, they have money, and they'll give you some.
But the downside of, like, marketing people is, like, they're there to market you, but sometimes they quit. And you're like, well, there's a new marketing person. They don't know your stuff as well, so they have to, like, learn how to promote you. And you end up doing a lot of the work yourself. Like, all of us are here promoting ourselves by ourselves at this con. Mm-hmm. And we do this all the time. Like, I do, like, maybe 8 to 10 comic conventions a year just so that I'm in the face of my readers. Sounds
obnoxious, but... Well, they're short. You can lean over.
You know, I feel like there's no better marketing than like, talking to people. So a marketing person with flyers and computers and connections can only do so much, but...
And I hear this appealing rumor that publishers actually pay you to go to these things. Is that true? Because I'm not far enough along with mine yet.
No.
Well, no, not pay you, but pay for you to go, cover your tables and all that other kind of stuff.
I've heard rumors too. I'm not at that point either, so I mean, it's been suggested to me that my publisher might send me on tour, but I have no idea.
Huh.
They might not.
Mine said they would, but they didn't do it.
Really?
So there you go.
Yeah.
They lie too.
they like to talk a good game, you know. Get you in. I'm sorry.
I have to say that I haven't had a single bad experience personally with my editors, with any designers, with anybody at Simon & Schuster.
Good.
It's just, I feel like the benefits far outweigh any sort of compromises that I would have to make. I'm getting great editorial feedback. They've been understanding when I couldn't make my deadlines. They've given me a lot of input on things like cover design, which I wasn't expecting at all. So, you know, they're not always out to get you.
Yeah. Well, cover design. I kind of had a different experience in terms of the cover for my book. It was just it ran for about 8 months. There's a lot of arguing on both sides about what would be an ideal cover for the book because, as I learned, that it turns out that the major American book chains like Barnes & Noble and Borders, basically their book buyers control what goes on a cover. They basically can say, if we don't like this cover, you know, we don't think it's going to sell to the age group that we think it'll sell to, we're not going to order as many. We're going to order maybe, you know, like 10,000 copies less of your book.
It's nice to have somebody to like do that work for you and know those things so that your chances are better of getting something that actually does hit.
Absolutely. So it was a big learning experience for me, because the designer that I had worked with we clashed against what the concept of the cover. I don't know if we sort of clashed on sort of what was we thought was ideal for kids, I guess, really.
Right.
In the end,
good.
So.
I get to work on my cover next week.
Cover meetings are not fun. They're like, aww. Especially if you're dealing with the major bookstores that are like, we don't want that to be blue, and you're like, but it's underwater. Like, what else is it going to be?
Yeah.
But yeah, I would agree that like from my experience, it's you know, publishers can be a little shady at times, but for the most part, they want your book to sell.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have the best interests at heart, and they've got a marketing machine behind them, which is able to sell it. So, is there anything else you guys wanted to talk about? Wanted to add any funny stories?
The Babysitter's Club was one of the most successful series in the history of publishing.
Yay.
Prior to the fact that it was a comic, so it was pretty well known. And there are some like kids out there and people my age out there that are still like so attached to the original property that when they saw it was a comic, they were just like, I want nothing to do with that. And these two 13-year-old girls, it's actually the only hate mail I've ever received, but it was also the first
really
mail of any sort that I received about the books when they first came out. And they made me this itemized list of why I was like the devil. And it boiled down to they don't like comics, they don't like cartoon style drawing, so but it was like, you're insulting the original author, and you're it was hysterical. Like, my parents, and they signed it like, you know, Kendra and Allison, age 13, like, you know, Walla Walla, Washington, or whatever. And I was like, I guess I could write them back. They put their addresses and their phone numbers on it.
Oh, no!
I was like, I could write them back, but it would just be me being defensive. Like,
you're just a kid.
When I was 13, I probably had angst too, so I'll just let it go. I've gotten some nice emails since then, so.
Gee, hate mail.
Yeah.
I've never had hate mail. Cool.
I love hate mail.
I'm kind of looking forward to it in a perverse sort of way.
I guess we should open up the floor to some questions now.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any questions for the panel?
I have not talked enough yet.
Those of you guys doing work for the class now, assuming it's sort of paying most of your money, how much time do you have for your own stuff? Is the work for hire stuff full-time, more than full-time, less than full-time?
depending on the deadline, I did a full book in 6 months, which meant I was basically working 14-hour days for an entire 6 months. Skipped Christmas, skipped New Year's, you know, it was hard. So yeah, it's full-time, and sometimes much more than full-time.
Right now I'm kind of struggling with that because I pencil really, really fast. And they're all excited, you know, because I can get the book penciled in this really blisteringly short period of time. But the inking doesn't go near so fast when I do it the way I've been doing it for my own work. So, you know, while I continue to, you know, rapidly pencil through the script, which, you know, took years off my life to write because I've never actually typed a script in my life. It's always just little scrawls of dialogue and little you know, thumbnail notes and stuff like that. And I had to actually write it so that somebody else could understand it and then revise it. That was a drag. Now I'm going to have to like come up with all these other different possibilities and kind of put little cake stand price tags on them. You know, okay, I can completely finish these pages just like this, and that will take X amount of time. And over here, you know, on door number 3, you have the modified pencil version, you know, with a few tones slapped onto it. You know, gee, it looks, you know, like this, and you can have that in this time period. Pick one. Because I just can't do the kind of inking that I'm accustomed to doing for my own work on this book in the time frame that they want. It's just impossible. The upside to the idea that they might pick one of the other versions is that I will have more time to throw together, you know, my own work and make it look the way I want it to. So, you know, there's trade-offs.
What do you guys think, though, if we were given, say, twice the amount of time, a deadline that's like twice the
amount? You'd have to have twice the money.
Well, yeah.
Because it spreads the money out to the point where,
you can survive off of it.
Maybe you can, maybe you can't, you know? Yeah. I mean, the money's good, but not if you take 10 years to finish something.
Yeah.
So,
personally, I don't think it's ever worth it. I did a 52-page full-color comic book, Work for Hire, for an educational book company that wanted to package it with a Spanish textbook, and it took me probably 2.5 months, and I had no time for anything of my own. It was awful.
How many pages was that?
32, but okay. It was full color.
Yeah.
And it was like, we're talking like 14 panel pages, because they weren't realistic about what you could fit per page.
Oh.
It was horrible.
14 panels per page.
Yeah, it was an average of like 11.
Did it come with
14.
A jeweler's loop, or was it just really big?
It was standard comic book
size. Really? Golly.
It was really bad. Anyway.
Sorry.
Unless I desperately needed the money, I don't think I could do that again.
Yeah, in my case, that was sort of what happened with me. I sort of had the first 60 pages when they picked me up, when they signed me to a contract. I had the first 60 pages completed, and basically I had about 8 months to put out, I think, 90 pages, which I thought at the time was pretty reasonable, and it really was, I think. But now they thought that, oh, he can do this in a short amount of time, because I already had like this buffer of pages that I had done already. So they said, you know, now we'll give you a year. So over that period of time, it took me about almost 2 years to do 150 pages, because I'm kind of slow, to be honest. So it took me 2 years to finish a 150-page book, and now they gave me 1 year to do 160 plus pages, because I'm still sort of writing it as I go along, and it's getting bigger, and it's kind of a hectic work schedule. So yeah. Should we do this?
I'm just wondering about as you're working with the editors, with your editors developing projects, and as you're working on the mainstream publishers, the editors that you're dealing with, I'm assuming, don't have, from what you're saying about the schedule, they don't have a handle on how long. are you educating them while they're editing you about how to tell stories in a graphic format? That you think the words or the pictures can carry more weight than the words often?
I know that my editor definitely understands that. She has a background in picture books, which has been really helpful.
I have a kind of a middleman editor in the form of Matt Madden, who of course knows every which way around the comic book that you want. And Matt's great. You know, they start talking about how I left out this caption or that caption that was in the script. You know, it's in the script, so it's got to go in the book. Matt, you know, just, you know, says blah, 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 and I go, oh. Whereas if I go blah, 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 they say, no, it was in the script. You know, I don't mean to make them sound like ogres. It's just this is not what they're used to. So, you know, yeah, there's give and take, you know. They'll figure it out.
I've certainly found, like, with my experience with my editor, is that she's always right. That's basically pretty much every suggestion she's made has been perfectly spot on. But we have had cases that sort of come down from copy editing, which are quite interesting. There was actually one scene where sort of Jellybee and Jason, one of the characters, sort of go off and they have to go to the bathroom on the train, and then there's a cut, and then they sort of come out, and Jason says, let's never talk about what happened in that bathroom ever again. And some of the people sort of higher up that saw it were really concerned that I was implying some sort of sexual connotation that went on in the bathroom that I did not see at all. And I have a pretty filthy mind already, and I'm like, I completely missed that. But I mean, my editor and I really felt strongly that the joke was good enough as it was, and we didn't want to change it. And so we sort of there's some interesting things that sort of trickle down from people that aren't in the editorial group, mm-hmm. which is.
It's easy to second guess things when you're seeing them, you know, 10 and 12 and 13 times before they're finished. So, you cut people some slack, and then sooner or later they'll relax most of the time.
I came from kind of like the indie comics side of things. So my comics were a little bit more experimental than like the Babysitter's Club would really allow for. So my editors were just like, you need to make sure you've got captions to say things like the next day. So, you know, to me, like, that's obvious, but since it's for kids, I don't know if like it would work, but you know, my judgment, like Keen said, they're always right, so they get the final say. But I work in thumbnail scripts. Like, I don't write out a script typed, I just draw it as like stick figures with word balloons coming out of their mouths and give that to my editors to edit from. And I expect them to understand what they're seeing, but they like comics, but they're not really people that have ever worked on comics before, so a lot of times I'll get a script approved with very few comments, and I'm like, wow, I must have done a great job. By the time I've penciled, inked, and had the book lettered, they'll look through the proofs and be like, oh, you know, this scene really doesn't work so well, and they'll ask me to fix things and change a lot of things that, if they had been able to read from the beginning, would not have meant that I already drew 10 pages that I had to scrap. But, you know, that's kind of just the nature of the beast. Like, I just expect that I'll be doing some of that. Hopefully not like 2 days before the thing is due, but.
I think the industry is experiencing a bit of a learning curve.
Yeah.
Graphic novels.
We're now building more time into my schedule for things just like that.
Yeah. I think that there's that whole idea that there's comic fans everywhere, and there's a lot of comic fans in mainstream publishers.
My home.
So, and like Raina said, they're fans, but they've never actually worked on a comic book before, so, but you know, they have the enthusiasm, they love the format, and they love the medium, so, you know, they're going to try their best, but that, I think that's what happens when you have a sort of young art form sort of bubbling to the surface. So. Any other questions?
No.
Is going to make you a little bit more open to a mainstream comic publisher?
Mainstream comic publisher meaning Marvel DC?
It's not mainstream at all.
They never wanted me before. I don't see why they want me now.
I had a kid ask me just today, like, so now that you're not an unknown anymore, do you think you're going to
Green Lantern?
Do some superhero comics? Actually, that's not what I got into this whole thing for, but he's like, wouldn't that be cool? I was like, oh, they paid me for it, sure. but
yeah, I couldn't ever imagine working for like a main, like a comics publisher unless they like wheeled in a barrel full of money for me, you know, like otherwise
be able to afford us first.
Yeah.
Actually, like Marvel and DC pay really, really good pay rates.
Right.
So like yeah.
I think it's, I'm not sure, but, well, because sort of, we're cross-promoting Jellybee with Disney Adventures,
right.
And I think the page rates are pretty comparable, and I'm, like, I'm more than happy to work on my, I would rather get paid peanuts to work on my own thing than...
Well, that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I sat down and had a beer with a colleague of mine who's been doing Marvel DC work for a long time, and figured out that what I'm getting paid for each of these two books that I'm under contract is about mid to upper level superhero work. So, you know, I mean, if I had a superhero I wanted to do and if anybody wanted to see me do it, yeah, sure. Which is a very slippery answer because I really can't answer it any better than that.
Yeah, I don't think I'm really in a position to even comment on that anyways because my book's not even out, so we'll see how it goes in the next year or so.
Sort of related to that, I was how mainstream book publishers, when they're looking for graphic novels, getting graphic novels, they're not interested whatsoever in what we consider mainstream comic books. They seem to be going directly to the independent small press or to underground.
Well, they've never really sold superheroes before, so they're trying to sell what they know. You know, they're selling The Babysitter's Club, which is a, you know, ridiculously successful series. They're, you know, selling Pendragon, which has also been very successful, although not nearly as long-lived. You know, there's, I hear tell of another adaptation of A Christmas Carol, stuff like that. I mean, some new projects, yes, but, you know, why would they be interested in what comics have done well when they've never sold comics? Very definitely. I mean, that's why they want to do so many adaptations right now. They'll edge into original work once they feel a little bit less worried about rolling the dough from the companies.
Say, well, sorry. Time for one more question. If there's one over here.
I was thinking about readers of Carl and everybody else.
Don't know yet. I mean, I haven't even, it hasn't even been announced what I'm doing. I had to actually call up my editor and find out it was okay for me to talk about it because there was nothing in the contract saying I couldn't, but, you know, I don't want anybody yelling at me because I blew some big secret or something.
I have a weird range. Like, I get the kids, which is who it's aimed at. It's targeted at, like, 9 to 12 year olds, but it skews as young as 6. Boys and girls.
Cool.
Yeah, six-year-olds who know how to read light comics. I get a lot of women my age who were fans of the series when we were kids, because the series came out when I was 9 years old, and I was a fan until I was probably 13 or 14. So it's like a nostalgia factor for them. And then I get a lot of, like, the dads of kids who are like, I have to admit, I really liked your book. And I'm like, it's okay. But they feel weird about it. Like, it's not okay for them to read about young girls and their adventures. But whereas I will always argue, girls have grown up all along, like, reading about boys' adventures, because that's what books are about up until recently. But, yeah, so I really get a broad range. And
that's
the books
cool.
have been on the shelves for about a year and 3 months. So I feel like it just keeps growing, which is cool.
Yeah, I get a broad range too, just because it's my comic's sort of been all over. It's been in flight anthologies, which is read sort of by an older age group, and it's been on the web, and again, so it sort of ranges from, you know, like from 7 to sort of 20s to 30 year olds. So I don't think I'm ever actually aiming towards a demographic in what I'm doing. So in particular, really.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.